Hello, this is Sarah.
And this is Dan.
And we'd like to welcome you to a special episode of Potty Pal. Oh, it doesn't sound as good out loud as it did written. It really doesn't.
No, it looks great spelled out. We're making a pun about paws because it's an episode about dogs.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome you to PD Pal and our episode about canine friends on palliative care teams.
Let's just get to the guests.
My name's Kamara Van Bremen, and I'm a nurse practitioner and a play therapist. I worked at Canuck Place Children's Hospice for about 27 years, actually. It's a provincial pediatric palliative care program, and my role is to support children in their home communities. And I also go to the hospital and see children in outpatient clinic or on the wards, do pediatric palliative care consultation. And I have a new tool in my toolbox, and her name is Gaia, and she is an amazingly trained PADS dog.
We're really excited to hear about her. Can you tell us a little bit about how you and Gaia found each other?
Well, it was quite a process. We actually had a dog named Poppy that worked with one of our physicians here for many years and was very loved by the children and families. Poppy left us a number of years ago, and when Poppy left us, she left a hole in our team. We didn't have a dog on our team anymore. So we started the process of finding Gaia, which means that when you apply for an assistance dog, it's quite a process. I would say it's similar to adoption. They have to check you out. They have to see how you live. They have to see if you're responsible. They wanted to know how we would utilize one of their highly trained dogs, what it would mean to our team. And I did this process with the nurse manager because one of the things that we learned from our colleague that had Poppy, don't do this alone. Make sure that you can support the dog well, because it's a lot of work. They are highly trained, highly sensitive, beautiful creatures that need a lot of attention. They trained us, and then they said, now we're going to wait to see which dog suits your facility. So we waited and we waited, and lo and behold, they phoned us one day and they said, we think we have the dog for you. Her name is Gaia, and we'd like you to meet her, and we'd like to have her come. And, you know, it wasn't a done deal. We had to then train with her, show them that we could work well together and that she could do the job for the work that she needed to do at hospital and in the hospice. And we were put on probation. When they came back, I think it was a month later, we had to run through all of her drills, all of her training. We had to really show them that she was responding to us, that we were bonded. They had to come back and watch her work with the children, come to the hospital. Fortunately, we were signed off and we've had her now for over 2 years.
That's an incredible story. And I don't think I could ever have imagined the extent of the process of training and preparation and probation that it takes. Although I guess it makes sense. It's almost more than we do for any humans who are joining our team. Was there particular training or particular skills that Gaia developed to work in the palliative care world that other kinds of assistive dogs don't?
You know, it's so interesting. Our partnership with PADS is so wonderful because they're experts in animals. And of course, we're experts in working with children who have serious illness. When we described what we needed, you know, around the emotional aspects of care that a dog can give, around being in very stressful situations, being with children in pain, being with very emotive parents, you know, we described that to the PADS people. And I can tell you, this dog is amazing in how she attunes to people. And she can be tired. She can have greeted 80 people in a day. And someone walks into the room and I say, Gaia, visit. She'll run over and be with them. She checks back in with me to see, is this right? Am I doing the right thing? And often then she'll go to the next person. If there's a group of people, she doesn't leave anyone out. You know, it's interesting because BC Children's Hospital has a lovely pet therapy visiting program where people bring their animals and their dogs to come and see kids. And of course, they love that. But I'll tell you a few amazing things about Gaia that are different than pets. She has been trained not to groom in public. She is very conscious of not sniffing too much. I mean, that is an instinct for dogs that tell them what their world is. And if she's sniffing too much, I say, leave it. And she stops. She will not shake or move if there's a loud bang or if there's someone wailing. If a wheelchair comes right up to her, she does not shy away. So when you actually think about her training and her ability to do those things, I can tell you how that manifests itself. One day I was asked to go to pick you for a child who was nearing end of life. He was in ICU on full support and had some bleeding. His tongue was very swollen and he was oozing blood. And, you know, it's with some trepidation that I asked Gaia to get up on the bed. The parents really wanted their son to be with, to meet Gaia, to get comfort from Gaia. The room definitely had odor from this bleeding and from this child's secretions. And yet when I asked Gaia to jump up on the bed, she carefully walked beside his limbs, making sure not to step on him. And she laid down right beside him and put her head on his chest. You can imagine, you know, for a dog to be in this environment of noise and smells and emotion, the parents were right beside him. She just settled down and was calm and was still. She was there. And when she got off the bed, she went to each of the family members and allowed them to pet her and emote and to be distracted, you know, with this beautiful creature that asks for nothing, just gives. So that's, you know, one example of a piece of her day. Lots of times her days are not that difficult. Just like pediatric palliative care specialists, we have those days and then we have to walk into another room and just be full of fun. You know, this is the first time the family's meeting us and the child's actually doing pretty well. We want to talk about what kind of supports we can do to get their family having more fun together, recreation outings. You know, she really does mirror what we have to do as well. You know, you go in and you have these hard, difficult conversations. And then the next thing you have to go and throw a ball figuratively with a family to engage and to create relationships so that you know you can support them further down the trajectory.
Does she come to consults routinely? Do you pick and choose which consult she comes to? How do you incorporate her and weave her into the fabric of day-to-day life doing these consults?
Yeah, I try to be fairly thoughtful about it. I mean, she gets requested sometimes by people now. You know, the oncology team will say, hey, so-and-so's coming. Can you bring Gaia? And it's not that I don't think about those things. It can be a nice tool. It might be a nice in. But I am very conscious. Am I coming as Chimera, the clinician, needing to do an in-depth consult, have some serious illness conversation where she will be helpful? Or will she be a distraction? And when I say distraction, it might be a distraction to me or it might be a distraction to the conversation of what we have to do. And it took me a while to get kind of a balance around that, I think. But, you know, she can be such a comfort to people, but she also can be such a distraction to people. And I think we all recognize that sometimes families want to distract themselves when we actually have to talk about some things that are ahead. And, you know, there are families culturally, you know, from different places, from different experiences. You know, I grew up on a farm, so my dad would think it's crazy that I have a dog that is such an indoor pet. So I really respect to and check out with families whether they want to see a dog or not, whether that's a fit for them or not. It's patient-centered. How do we add this tool in that makes sense for them? Some of our families that have immigrated to Canada, the kids really want to see the dog and be with the dog. But the parents are sort of like, in my country, dogs are, you know, used for guarding or dogs can be used for in the military. And so they're not necessarily as open to a pet dog, whereas the kids might be wanting to visit. So you have to balance how to invite her into a room. You have to be very respectful that some people don't think the dog should be on a bed or should be in the hospital room.
Often in pediatric palliative care, we're in a unique situation where our team is not always understood or wanted by the people who are consulting us. I know I've been in situations where a consulting team has asked us, we want to consult you, but we just want the social worker, or we just want the chaplain, or this is just symptom management. And our traditional answer, and I think the answer that a lot of teams around the country end up giving, is no. When you consult us, you're consulting palliative care, and that means the whole team. Do you get consults that are like, just Gaia, please? And how do you respond to that?
Yeah, so I totally hear you. I think, I guess the short answer is yes. But what I do appreciate about that is, yeah, invite me into the room. Invite the social worker into the room. You just want to see the doc for now for pain and symptom management? We are going to show up. That person's going to show up. And then we're going to work with the family to determine what services of ours they need. But if I get in through the door and I sit on the bed with Gaia and I learn about a family and I find out that the sibling is struggling, and then I offer our social work support, and then I learn really the nausea is not really being managed. Even though it's helpful to have Gaia on the bed, the nausea is a little bit better. Maybe we could add in a medication. For me, you know, even a little invite, even if they only want a little bit of us, that crack can turn into an expansive service delivery way. So yeah, I use her. It's another in for me.
If you find she's helpful for someone's anxiety or nausea, how does utilizing her as part of that symptom management plan look like?
I'll speak to a little girl that I followed for many months, actually. So she was a relapsed neuroblastoma. And what I would say about Gaia with this little girl was it got me in the room. She was so helpful for this girl's pain. It was unbelievable. She would be in a lot of pain. They would be waiting for a breakthrough medication. They would be in the clinic. And she would, you know, even say, oh, Gaia's here. You can hold off. I won't need my breakthrough. When kids recognize that there's non-pharmacologic things that help them, there's an opening to being able to discuss more of that. So for me, the in was, can I come and visit? I'll bring Gaia. And maybe what we could do is a little bit of some mind-body work and relaxation work, because I notice when you pet Gaia and you have this softness and this sort of repetitive stroking, that your mind relaxes, your body relaxes, your pain becomes less. And we have these great Gaia look-alike stuffies that have a beanbag inside and they have a little vest. And so I bring those out and I'll say, like, you got real Gaia now, but you also have stuffy Gaia. And I'm wondering if we can do some relaxation, some breathing, some four square breathing with our stuffy Gaia and with real Gaia to see if that can help. So yeah, I think she offers an opportunity to look at more non-farm things instead of going right to the medications. And I have to say, this little girl ended up dying, and she ended up dying in hospital and was shocking to mom almost in a way. Well, I phoned her and I have the mementos. We make mementos. And I said, I have the mementos ready. I'm wondering if you want to meet with me and Gaia. And she said, oh, can we go for a walk with Gaia? So we met at a dog park and we went for a walk. We have quite a robust bereavement follow-up service at Canuck Place, which I'm so grateful for. We have families that met Gaia, got comfort from Gaia while their child was alive or the sibling. And she attends grief counseling sessions too. So one of our social workers, I've given her some support in some of the commands and the training and the supports Gaia needs. So she'll book Gaia. I need Gaia for 8 o'clock in the morning because sibling so-and-so is coming in. Is that okay? And so she utilizes her in a different way. And again, it's just remarks about what a difference that makes in her practice. And again, not every session, not every kid, but she's a tool.
She's a tool, but I also hear so much of how she's a team member and such a vital team member. And
yeah, you can't have a facility dog that's like a pet, because what happens is everybody gives treats. She doesn't have the routine, the boundaries she needs. And so it is interesting. We have found, Brenda and I, in training a couple people, that we have to make it very consistent, because if it's not consistent, she doesn't do her commands. She doesn't feel good about it. It's not fair to her, you know, to have confusing commands. And so it's really a balance of saying, like, who are you as a dog? Who are we as a team? How do you integrate into that and make sure that she knows her role and who her supervisor is? because when she has too many supervisors, just like any of us, she doesn't know what to do. So a chain of command is important, and consistency is really important.
I cannot imagine anybody listening to this and saying, Gaia sounds amazing. I want a Gaia. Our team should have a Gaia, and starting the advocacy process. And along the lines of what you were just saying, are there other important pieces of advice you would give to teams who are looking for a canine member?
Yeah, so I think the partnership with the assistance dog people, whoever they are in BC, it's PADS, of course. I think creating a relationship with them is really important. The other people I want to mention is YVR, so our airport foundation that gives donations to Canuck Place. YVR actually sponsored her. They cost a lot of money. So even though PADS doesn't charge us for her, in terms of vet, feeding, supplies, you know, all of those things, it takes money, and it takes a commitment from the organization to say, we will support you to have this dog. So that's really important. Someone mentioned, and I don't know if this is right, but in terms of her breeding to training, she probably is a $30,000 investment. And with that comes this responsibility of, one, to keep her safe and well cared for and the right weight. I think when you think about the responsibility of this dog that so many people put energy in and did all of this, how do you really hold that and hold the people that are in charge to account? One of my little friends asked me, you know, if you ever lost Gaia, do you think you'd be fired? I said, absolutely, I would be. Do you think you'd lose your job if you ever lost Gaia? I think so. So, you know, I hold that, you know, that I have to, you know, she's in my charge, and I have a big responsibility. And I really appreciate, from my CEO down, I feel very supported in having her. Our housekeepers, we always get them extra gifts at Christmas because they have to clean up so much hair. They are like so good. But again, if you're going to have a dog in the facilities, you need to talk to the people who are taking care of her. And I have so much gratitude to our housekeepers because I still love Gaia more than I hate her hair, but her hair is a lot. So, you know, if you're going to get a dog in a facility, talk to the people who are going to be impacted by her, both in a good way or in a way that requires energy and work.
So we said this before we started recording, but I'll repeat it on the air. I wish Gaia could be here with us today so that we could meet her as well. She's busy working. But we will, for our listeners, put a picture up or a link up on our podcast notes so that you can see what Gaia is like. Yeah, she's a beautiful dog.
She's really impacted my life. And I'm actually kind of surprised how much she has. She has no judgment. She just is. And I think as palliative care clinicians, we want to enter every room with that openness, you know, and that ability to be quiet and calm and sensitive. So yeah, she helps me be a better practitioner, I think.
Hi, my name is Becca. I'm one of the nurses on the pediatric palliative care team at Mott Children's Hospital, and I'm also one of Fawn's primary handlers.
Hi, my name is Tricia Kiefer. I am a physician on the Stepping Stones pediatric palliative care team at CS Mott Children's Hospital, and I am one of Fawn's backup handlers.
We have two handlers for Fawn here. What does Fawn's handler family look like?
Fawn's had, I think, a total of 7 people trained as her handlers. There's a lot of ebbs and flows with the timeline of who's on the team and who's got the most availability over the time that she's been with us, which has now been about 3.5 years. And we try to get people from all different backgrounds. She recently actually changed her primary handler. Previously, our chaplain, Rachel, was her primary handler, and it switched over to Becca. Elizabeth, our social worker, and I have been backup handlers for all of her time with the team. And then Priyanka, our other social worker, is also one of her handlers.
Dogs love routine, and dogs love consistency. And you have all of these people cycling, I imagine, in and out if they're not all in service at the same time. How does Fawn do with that?
Over time, Fawn's kind of adapted to the flexibility of our team. Currently, right now, she's primarily handled by a smaller group of those handlers. So I think her day-to-day is actually more structured than it probably sounds. But we have just a couple of us that kind of rotate in and out based on patient needs. Many of Fawn's days kind of start and end with usually with me. And then we kind of have people rotate in and out, or if I'm on vacation, Trisha or Elizabeth will have her for more chunks of time. But we kind of try to keep a primary person for the day at the very least, so that she knows kind of who her guiding light is for that day.
And then what does a day look like for Fawn?
Fawn has her whole morning routine at home after a very good night of sleep. And then she rolls into work. Usually she has a little bit of downtime in the morning while we kind of look through our patient lists and get together for rounding. She'll attend rounds with us via Zoom or in person, depending on what we're doing that day. And then we kind
of... She typically sleeps through rounds.
Yes. Yeah, she sleeps through them. And then we go through a list of who might be helpful to see in our different disciplines, as well as who Fawn might be a really good asset for in conversations or symptom management, any concerns that people have that they think Fawn might really connect with the family and support them in. And then we kind of either go in small groups with different members of our team, or sometimes Fawn and I will do some individual visits based on whatever the patient's preference are or what the conversation goals are. We kind of go where the patients need us that day. And at some point in the middle of the day, she has a break time and usually plays in the dog run with some of the other facility dogs here, and then go about our afternoon and eventually go home for dinner, which is one of her favorite activities.
I'm really curious how Fawn found you, how you found Fawn, how Fawn fits into the canine family that's at Mott Children's, and what it was like to advocate for her being dedicated to the team.
Gosh, it must have been like 7 or 8 years ago. It was probably prior to that. One of our chaplains who saw patients all over the hospital and then our peds ICU each ended up getting a therapy dog. And one of our team members, Fawn's prior handler and chaplain, came to me and said, "Hey, this seems like a really good idea." I said, "I have been thinking the exact same thing. We should try to figure out how to make this happen." After many pitches to many people philanthropically, because taking on a dog costs some money, we were able to get a grant through PetSmart. They gave us the seed money to get Fawn and to get her training done and to cover her first year here at Mott Children's Hospital. And following that, the whole Paws for Patients program, which has grown quite a bit since she got here, was endowed. And Mott has taken on several more dogs who work all over the hospital.
You almost make it sound easy. You almost make it sound like you called up PetSmart and they said, "Great, yes, absolutely." But what was that sell really like? And for our listeners who are looking up the PetSmart and the Petco corporate numbers and thinking about how they're going to bring this to their programs, what advice do you have to give, or what did you learn from doing the process?
So we actually looked a lot of different places and asked a lot of different people for money. So no, it was not easy at all. I found the PetSmart grant when I was looking for things for my own dog online. And I was like, "Oh, this looks like it fits." I sent the description to our grant specialist within the Department of Pediatrics, and she said, "Yeah, that seems reasonable. You should try." I cleared it through the chief operating officer of the hospital. And then it was a typical grant application and budgeting, but with very different line items on the budget. Food and veterinary costs were just a little different than writing up one for some sort of research study. It's been more challenging to figure out how to best make sure that she's able to impact as many patients as possible. Everybody wants to see her, and there are some patients who are going to be more high needs or, you know, less high needs on any given day.
So what is that kind of triaging process like? How do you decide who has the highest need for Fawn?
I think the easiest one is anybody who's on contact precautions or droplet precautions can't see her. So that rules out a fair number of patients, although sometimes we'll go to the door and the patient will come sort of near the door and wave at her. When I handle her, because I'm typically on service as the physician on service, I just go see all the patients except for the ones on contact precautions and don't really triage her visits quite as much because of the role that I have on the team and what I need to do to make sure that my own work gets completed.
I think a lot of the triage is based on how much impact we think Fawn has the potential to make. So I might prioritize conversation with a teenager who really feels connected with Fawn that we really need to have maybe a more difficult conversation that they might benefit from having that support there. And maybe if there's a set time, I might prioritize trying to put that visit ahead of some others and then kind of scooch in whatever visits I can around that. Kids with symptom management needs, a lot of times she gets requested for pain or distraction, and those ones I prioritize pretty high. That's a good non-pharmacological option that we can offer to people and something that she can kind of acutely impact right away. And then we try to do some of the visits that are more like, if we could just stop by because it would be fun, or maybe the sibling is there that day and thought it would be cool to meet a dog and that might help change their perspective on the hospital experience. We put those into, but those tend to be a little bit lower priority.
What did collecting pre and post data on Fawn's visits look like? And what did measuring Fawn's impact look like?
For our grant measurement, we tried not to aim too high. We went with primarily patient satisfaction survey, you know, and anecdotes, and then just with sheer numbers of patients impacted. Our previous handler did a great job of not only quantifying her visits, but she also helped support quantifying her hallway visits, just so that we could give them a sense of how often does she stop in the hallway to meet a patient who's not part of her daily routine, which I will say, since she came to us pre-COVID with a ton of patients, and then she took some time off during COVID because there was not a lot of data about whether or not you should have therapy dogs in a hospital or not. But then post-COVID, we've had less child visitors in the hospital, and so she hasn't seen as many people. We're just starting to emerge from that.
I think that's something I found really interesting about being Fawn's handler is how many people she impacts on the day-to-day that aren't even in her specific patient groups. Like seeing people in the halls, seeing staff members smile, people get excited to see her or know her, know she walks by a certain area at a certain time of day almost always. And people really, I think, look forward to it. And I think it changes the environment for staff and for patients and for families. And it really has a big impact.
The part that probably underestimated is how much the staff loves her. I would probably say she supports as many staff as patients every day. Just walking through the neonatal ICU, she gets stopped a lot of times. She visits the house officer rooms and meets them. She's very popular all over the hospital with all sorts of staff. And it's funny how often you'll hear people say, oh, this made my day, or gosh, this was exactly what I needed today. That piece is really exciting and for me was unexpected.
Being able to quantify the impact of our curbsides is something that a lot of teams are struggling with a dog or no. And I feel like a lot of times we're walking down the hall and we happen to have a conversation with this or that team or whatever, talk to the residents, they happen to run a case by us, and that's hard to quantify. But we know there's that intangible impact that the team has just being there. And it's also like the staff support stuff, which seems to varying degrees to be part of our job as palliative care clinicians. But it's always hard to write a note and be like, the fellow cried on my shoulder. So similarly, like fellow snuggled with a dog feels better. It's really important. And yet, how do we like make that a meaningful measure?
Well, and even for our own team, right? You know, if you go to a hard consult that she's not at and come back to the team room and snuggle the dog as the attending palliative care doctor, it's meaningful and it's very, very helpful to try to process some of the emotion that comes with the sort of work that we do.
So I saw Sarah's eyebrows go up when you mentioned the NICU, and I do want to get back to that.
The idea of bringing a dog through the NICU, I think, took me by surprise. I don't know if it's because the NICU patients might not feel the impact as much, but there are still families and there's still staff members in that space. And so I'm wondering how getting to the NICU and how walking through the NICU is, and if there's anywhere you've had pushback bringing Fawn.
So we were lucky because one of the first dogs in the hospital was actually in the pediatric ICU, and saying it's okay to go to the ICU was sort of already asked and answered prior to our initiation of Fawn on our team. It's always a choice, right? We don't force anybody to see the dog. Part of the training is that you knock on the door, you ask if it's okay to come in with the dog, you explain the rules. People have to use hand sanitizer before and after they pet her. And then the other piece is that the dogs are kept pretty immaculate. Becca could speak more to that because she's in charge of taking her to grooming.
We keep the dogs quite clean. They get professionally bathed and groomed once a week. If they get into anything at home, just being a dog, they get baths at home. They're usually groomed daily by the handlers, and we have bathing wipes that we use when they're coming in and out from outside times. So they're kept pretty clean. And I would say from my nursing background, I feel even more paranoid about making sure that the dog is clean before she's visiting with patients. And if they're going to visit like in bed, then we usually put down blankets too, like bath blankets, so that the dog is getting up and can get off on a blanket that we can remove so that the patient's not got dog hair in their beds.
This is a very random question, but as you mentioned dog hair, it's starting to make me think about, do you run into issues with like allergies that people have? Is Fawn hypoallergenic? What? And also, as I'm thinking about this, what does Fawn look like? What kind of dog is Fawn? I can't picture in my head.
You got to bring her into the picture, Becca.
She's laying on. I'll get her up here in a second. Fawn is a 5-year-old golden retriever. Yeah, you come here. She's a 5-year-old golden retriever. She's very fluffy and definitely not hypoallergenic. She sheds quite a bit, but the professional baths once a week help a lot. They do a lot of de-shedding, and then we use grooming rakes and things to kind of keep her as hair-free as possible. There are a lot of people who have allergies and decide they still want to pet the dog, and they just are very careful about hand washing before and after and don't just like snuggle her with their faces close by. They're pretty careful about that. Let me see if I can get her. Hey, Fawny, you come here. Come here. Did I get you a snack?
Oh, yeah, there you are. Hi.
I feel like both dogs and snacks are two things that bring joy wherever they go.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Fawny, come up here. You paws up. Thank you. This is Fawn.
Oh,
can you say hi, Bubba? So definitely not hypoallergenic, but pretty cute.
And the Paws for Patients program does have an Instagram. So if you need more pictures of her, it's Paws, the number 4, Patients.
It's a great serotonin booster. It's dogs all day, every day.
We can put a link up on our show notes for all of our listeners who are enjoying this audio-based medium and cannot see this dog. Do you have, as part of your symptom management bundle, like PRN Zyrtec for kids who like need a dog visit?
We do not.
No.
It's not a smart phrase that we use in our ER. I haven't had a lot of patients who have struggled with the allergy portion. I don't know if it's because they don't share it because they want the dog to come back. I think the one thing that we do once a month or so, we get a request for a different sort of therapy animal, like, where's your therapy cat? and so I think that that is one of the entertaining pieces, because it is hilarious to imagine walking around the hospital with a little cat on a leash.
So now I'm imagining a whole menagerie of different therapy animals.
It's somehow written into one of the policies that you can have a miniature therapy horse, I think, on site. So we have talked about how we could fund that one, but we haven't come up with any good ideas just yet.
I think the VA here in Los Angeles does have a miniature horse as a therapy animal. I did once do a visit with a cat. It was a patient's request to see one of her cats. And when we brought that cat in on a leash, and let me tell you, it was chaos. It was, you know, holding the leash, the cat trying to dart under things. It's hard to imagine an animal better suited for therapy work than a dog. But I'm wondering if there's any times where Fawn's dogness has taken over in a way that maybe was detrimental, or maybe was surprising, or maybe was not what you expected.
I think anytime that there is food involved, sometimes Fawn's greater sense of smell does distract her a little. I would say if there's food around, we have to usually have people put it up if they want to visit.
On the breakfast tray. Oh, it's trouble for her.
Oh yeah. Breakfast is a favorite meal.
She's okay if we move it like to the other side of the room or something, but if it's sitting like with a patient, she's going to struggle.
Who among us though? I mean, like I also... If I haven't had breakfast and I walk into the room, it's a struggle for me too. Yeah.
I think you're probably less likely to steal the bacon, which she, in fact, I think if given the opportunity, would do.
I appreciate your faith in me.
This is a tangent question, but when we think about dogs and how they're suited to be therapy animals, we often think about how dogs have this special connection with people that you could almost call empathy. You can almost call sympathy. You can almost call that sort of sense that they understand emotion and they understand what's going on in the room. And I'm wondering what that has looked like for Fawn, and if Fawn mourns. I know it's sort of a strange question, but if Fawn gets attached to people, if Fawn notices the absence of people.
I think that is a really good question that to some extent we can only kind of ponder or think about and interpret her behavior the best that we can. She definitely has patients that are maybe more engaged with her, that she gets excited to see or knows their name when you say, do you want to go see so-and-so? And she gets excited about that, or will stop by the room that they've been in. So if somebody's in the same room or the same area pretty often, or even if they've moved areas, but they're still kind of on the same floor, she will usually stop outside their room and wait to see them. And I would say she will do that even after somebody leaves occasionally. She'll stop by a room. I don't know if it's out of habit or if it's because it smells familiar and like that person, but she's pretty clear that she wants to go in if she knows a kid and has bonded with them a lot. Because of her training and I think her security and bond, she's able to kind of overcome maybe any feelings of mourning that she might have pretty quickly. But she definitely notices when people are somewhere regularly and when they're not there, I would say.
I think from a empathy perspective, she has a great sense of what's going on in a room, you know, when she's on her game, when there's no bacon. In particular, where I've seen her be incredibly responsive to how the room is in end-of-life circumstances, where she'll get into bed with the patient and the family will be petting her and she'll just sort of curl up and do her thing, where she's not necessarily interacting. She's just being, and being calm and being part of that experience. And she can do it for a lot longer than I think any other animal I've ever seen. And in a way that it just really soothing for patients and families.
I think I've noticed too, if somebody's uncomfortable, pain or something else is really nausea is really bothering them, she tends to be more careful about like jostling their bed, maybe where how she's walking. She doesn't want to put pressure on them or something that might make them uncomfortable, more hesitant to be directly like in the bed with them and might want to just stand by the bed so that they can pet her. And we've had a couple instances where we've walked out of room and been like, oh, that's kind of odd behavior. And then later learned that there was more going on with that patient than we had realized in that moment. So I think she's pretty clear. She'll sometimes look at you with that look like, I know something you don't. And we learn later on what it was.
How has Fawn changed your team? Like, has having Fawn changed the way your team operates, relates with each other, relates with other teams?
There's definitely this sort of shared responsibility for her and her well-being and recognizing which patients she might be good for. And when she's in the team room, you know, who's watching her. So I think that there's a lot of team building that goes around, you know, having this almost parenting relationship. It's hard because she's somewhere between a coworker and my niece. And it's hard to draw the line of where that exactly is. She also just does so much outreach for us being a less scary team. I think last time we talked, we were talking about, you know, whether or not to rename your team. We still live on the fence about whether or not we should call ourselves the Stepping Stones Pediatric Palliative Care, which is our official name, but is kind of a mouthful versus just saying we're from palliative care. And I think Fawn has made it less about what that name is and more about, oh, that's right, you guys are the ones with the dog. It's nice to not have to do that dance. And she sort of gets us in the door to be able to do good work in a way that perhaps we might not have with some other families. So I do think it helps sort of with earlier palliative care. It's actually hard to not get consults that are like, okay, well, this patient just really needs to see a dog. And they're like, well, but they're not actually right for palliative care. Let's figure out what other canine resources we have at the hospital, which, you know, we're really fortunate. We've got other canine resources that we can help bring to patients if they're not the right fit for the rest of the sort of things that our team is able to help with.
Do you lead with Fawn? Do you lead with the least scary sounding part of your team?
During the course of our consult, usually towards the end, say, oh, and by the, or sometimes while we're introducing, but by the way, we have a really big team. And then we list all the team members. And usually I say her last. And, you know, just so you know, we also have a therapy dog. If you're interested in seeing her, you know, just let us know. If you're not into dogs or you are not comfortable with dogs, let us know as well. And we'll make sure that we don't bring her by.
If she's with us already, then she likely will go to a first consult if a family's interested. If she's not with us already, we just mostly screen to see if that's something they'd be interested in. And sometimes I think we do use her as an opportunity to come back. Like, oh, well, when we come back, we can bring the dog and then have more of this discussion.
So what is Fawn's work schedule? 5 days a week, 9 to 5? Is she a couple days a week, part-time, full FTE, half? How often is she with you?
Fawn can work up to 40 hours a week, I think is what she's officially billed for. But she mostly just follows the schedule of whoever's handling her.
We spent a lot of time working out schedules for her over the years to make sure that she's matched with somebody who is going to have the flexibility with their day to be able to have her not be stuck in documentation or Zoom meetings all day, but really able to help her do her best work.
I just love this picture of her stuck in Zoom meetings all day. I just love the mental image of it.
She's not the greatest Zoom attendee, I would say. She often falls asleep and snores under the desk at inopportune times. Often we have moments where we have to be like, that's our dog. I'm really sorry she snores. But she does sometimes go on video visits if kids really love her. We'll sometimes have Fawn in the office with us and be like, oh, do you want to see the dog? And that kids absolutely love that. I think it's very unexpected for them.
Tricia, earlier you had mentioned the negatives of having a team dog, and I heard you allude a little bit to maybe some anxieties or maybe some situations that Fawn has that makes her uncomfortable. I'm wondering if you can expand on that, because right now it sounds great. It sounds perfect. It sounds like sunshine and rainbows and everyone should have a dog. But what are some of the negatives that you have experienced?
Putting my like medical director of the program hat on, I think some of the negatives are making sure that all the other people who are handling her are able to get their jobs done as well. So sometimes it's hard to be a doctor and a Fawn handler, but yet, you know, I'm getting paid to be a doctor and it's just gravy that I get to hang out with Fawn and get to take her with me. But I have to make sure I get my job done too. So that's a piece of it. She needs to go out and she needs to drink water at certain times. And she just takes a different amount of care than me walking through the hall by myself does. Takes a lot longer to get places because she does all this curbside hallway chat far more than anybody ever wants to curbside me. They want to see her.
One of the big ones, I think, for her is like her energy level. So being able to pay attention to kind of what's happening in a room, but also how Fawn is engaging with people. And if she sees a lot of people on the way into a patient interaction, sometimes she's not quite as settled in the patient interaction, can kind of take a little bit of her energy cup, drain a little bit. So kind of being able to pay attention to how long she might be able to stay in an interaction. Sometimes if she's got to go outside or is hungry or has, you know, maybe there's the bacon there that day, her attention span is a little bit shorter. So there's a lot of energy too in trying to just kind of make sure that Fawn is comfortable enough to do really good work. She might have seen 4 or 5 patients in the morning and they might've been really hard visits. And so then she might not really be up for visits later in the day. And so sometimes that doesn't necessarily always work with workflows of being able to say, I still have to see these kids.
Do you find that it helps you also keep track of your own energy levels and find time to rest and take a break and drink and, you know, go for a walk outside or whatever it is you need to do? Like,
I think for me personally, for sure, she's a good gentle reminder that maybe if she's taking a sip of water, I should also be drinking some water. Or if she's taking a moment to rest, I can sit down and relax for a minute before typing up a note. So I think for sure. Or sometimes she just reminds me that, like, it's okay to walk a little slower in the hallway. I don't have to run there. It's not going to be 1 minute versus 5 minutes of walking isn't going to change anything. Or she's a good gentle reminder too to interact with people in a way that I might not otherwise. I might turn in a little bit and want a little quiet time, but sometimes it's really nice and rewarding to have positive interactions with patients and staff in the hall that I wouldn't have engaged in if they hadn't been excited about seeing Fawn and telling her about their day or fun things that they're up to or being proud of something they might have accomplished.
Sorry, that's my dog.
I think she is a good gentle reminder that self-care is important, and sometimes it is nice to just walk outside between buildings to get some sunshine.
I tend to be somebody who, if I don't have carpools to drive in the evening or something to do when I'm on service, you know, I might stay sort of late to try to get stuff done. And around 5:30 or when everybody else is saying goodbye, she's done and she'll let you know I am done for the day. And so you can't stay here till 8 trying to catch up on paperwork or writing that next grant or doing whatever. She helps me get home to hang out with my family and have a little bit of downtime when I'm on service. So she's pretty clear with me about what her hours are.
Fawn, you've been very quiet. Any comments from you? Last words of wisdom or snores?
She is snoring. She did heavy sigh at least a couple times and yawn. So I think she has been completely relaxed and comfortable throughout this podcast and is very much so telling people they should come listen.
Excellent. That's exactly what I was hoping.
So one of my favorite things about having these two dogs on is that they are both dogs, but they feel very different and they feel like individuals. And I laugh a little bit at hearing about Fawn and her love for bacon and how that didn't come up with Gaia. And I'm reminded of one of my favorite news headlines I ever read. Airport dogs, great at finding sausages, bad at finding bombs, if you remember that one.
Yeah, yeah.
But they really came across as individuals in a way that was really, really refreshing. Reminds me a little bit about how each team is individual, a little bit about each member is individual. But both of them just brought joy, and both of them excelled. One thing they had in common is they both excelled at presence and just being present. And I think that's a lesson we heard both of our sets of guests take with them, but I think a lesson I'm taking with me too about the impact a dog can make is just being present. And sometimes that's the impact that we make too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it. That's you said it. I don't have much to add to that. Maybe I'm just being present and bringing that to our outro, but yeah, these dogs are members of the team. Not in the same way that the human members of the team are, but they also bring their personality and they bring, I hesitate to call it a skill set, but it kind of is a skill set.
It is a skill set. Think about the amount of training that was described for both dogs, 18 months to 2 years. It is a very rigorous schooling for these dogs to be able to do this. And I'm reminded of during our recording with Gaia, when my dog heard someone at the front door, zoomed out of the room and took the microphone with her. I don't think that's going to make it into the audio. But just thinking about how some of those dog instincts, can't train the bacon out, but you can train some of the rest out, are honed and changed and sought after, right? Not every dog is naturally going to be a therapy dog. And we talk a lot about how palliative care is a trainable skill.
Yes, and not an innate skill. Yes, this is exactly what I was about to say. Yeah. the same way that we go to fellowship and have some of our natural tendencies and natural talents honed. And now I'm thinking back to our episode where Chris Feudner and Joanne Wolf were talking about training palliative care clinicians. It's important to think about what these dogs do and what these dogs have as a skill set in the same way that it's important to think about palliative care as a skill set. Because if we just attribute everything the dogs do to like instinct and animal intuition, well, it's easy to just attribute what we do to like empathy and being a good communicator. Maybe I'm stretching that a little too far, but I do see the parallel there. One thing that we could talk about, especially in the context of our last episode about psychology, we talked about how psychology provides a unique but overlapping domain with some of the other members of the palliative care team. I think we can think about a dog in the same way, right? Like there are certain things that a dog can do that only a dog can do for a palliative care team. But then there are other things.
Well, I mean, yeah, among other things.
Yeah. Usually I wouldn't recommend that. But yeah, there are things that only the dog can do. And there are things that like we all can be generalists in that the dog is a specialist in.
And that being present really feels like the specialty.
Yeah. I think that's right. I also think the thing that Becca and Tricia were talking about, where Fawn helps them stop and smell the bacon a little bit, talk to people, interact, walk a little slower, take a sip of water. Like we can all do a little bit of that too. I think that's important to remember for our professional lives.
Thanks for listening. Our theme song is provided by Kevin McLeod. You can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @PDPal. You can find the notes for this podcast and all of our episodes on PDPal.org. If you'd like to submit thoughts, objections, or ideas for future episodes, please reach out via the email on our website. This has been PDPal. We'll see you next month.
I think the only requirements just with the system our hospital is in, they need to see a nurse practitioner or a physician at one of their visits to officially complete our consult.
When you
I was just going to say that answers my question about whether or not Fawn can write billable notes. And I guess the answer is no. Yeah.
Nope.